Welcome back to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu. In December, the Bush administration took a significant step toward relaxing restrictions on doing business in Vietnam. U.S. companies are now allowed to set up offices in the country and sign contracts that are contingent upon an end to the trade embargo against Vietnam. The move was in response to the Vietnamese government's cooperation on the POW-MIA issue. What does the latest U.S. policy change mean? Will the embargo be lifted soon, and will diplomatic ties between the two countries be restored? To explore the answers to these questions, we'll turn to three guests. On the phone is Douglas Pike. He is the director of the Indochina Studies Program at UC Berkeley. Joining us in the studio is Michael Scown, chair of the Indochina section of the California Southeast Asia Business Council. We are also expecting a third guest, Chen Vu, publisher of the weekly Vietnamese language newspaper Thời Sự or Current Events. He should be arriving shortly, hopefully. Welcome to the two of you. My first question to Mr. Scown and Mr. Pike, what does the latest relaxation in trade restrictions against Vietnam portend for diplomatic relations between the two countries? Douglas Pike, let's begin with you.
Well, I see this essentially as a domestic American political problem and not a, in any real sense, a U.S.-Vietnam bilateral problem or matter. Therefore, the answer to that question lies in what happens in domestic politics in the United States with the advent of the Clinton administration.
Michael Scown?
Well, I think I'd agree with Doug. The issues that are linked to normalization now are really internal political issues for the United States. I think what we're seeing, though, is a return to a more normal state of affairs between the U.S. and Vietnam, and it looks like after 17 years of isolation, Vietnam may be getting ready to join the world community again.
Douglas Pike, let me ask you this. Do you think the embargo will be lifted before Bush leaves office?
No, I think it's very doubtful.
Why?
Well, I think Bush feels that he has done the last thing that he's going to do. He reciprocated for the return or for the appearance of these photographs and John McCain's helmet and so on, and that that's the last thing that he's going to do. He could do Clinton a big favor by recognizing Hanoi. I would certainly advise him to do this if I were advising him. But I think I understand this from people in Washington and the White House, that he has simply said this is the last thing that he's going to do. He does have the opportunity, actually, to write the last sentence of the last chapter of the Vietnam War. Exit as a real statesman, but
I'm pretty sure
that he's not going to do that.
Why do you think he's not taking the opportunity to go out and make a historical mark?
Well, he may not want to do Bill Clinton that much of a favor. This is going to be a problem for Clinton, and so memories of the campaign are long. And whereas he doesn't want to do something nasty, he said that, you know, I'm not going to do this out the door. Dirty tricks thing, which some presidents do. They make appointments for five-year jobs, or they sign legislation and pass problems on to their successor. He said he's not going to do this, but I don't think it extends so far that he's going to do Bill Clinton that much of a favor. He should, but I don't think he is.
Michael Scown, does that worry you, the possibility of possibly not having an end to the embargo before Bush leaves office? Your organization has been pushing for an immediate end to the embargo.
Right. I think it puts American businesses in a real bind, because we're at the stage now where people are going to be allowed to open offices, hire staff, and do everything except make money. The cost of doing business is going to be large. It's a difficult environment in which to live and operate, and any business that's contemplating opening up over there is going to have to make some hard choices over whether they're willing to risk those expenses on the basis that Clinton will do something in the early days of his administration. Under the terms of the roadmap, which is the name given to the phased-in plan for normalization of relations between the U.S. and Vietnam, there are four steps. The steps that Bush took were in the latter part of what's regarded as phase two of the roadmap. Now, the last remaining step under phase two would be for Bush to agree to have the U.S. assist Vietnam with taking care of its arrears in the International Monetary Fund. And that's what Vietnam is really waiting for, because once international aid starts coming in, that's when Vietnam's economy is going to start taking off. Until that happens, the Vietnamese are still left waiting, as is American business. I think Bush has fairly neatly boxed Clinton in, because he's going to have a difficult time leaving the embargo in place once American businesses are over there and are actually on the ground and have something set up there. You know, to date, there hasn't been that much pressure from American business. I think a lot of people have been worried about the possible public relations aspects of the issue, since the Vietnam War is such a sensitive issue in the American psyche.
Is it realistic, though, to expect that Clinton will act quickly on this issue? He, during the election campaign, he was often cited for his anti-war activities.
Well, I think Clinton made a number of promises, as any presidential candidate did, and one of them was that he would link internal human rights issues within Vietnam to a lifting of the embargo, and would also make sure that all of the POW MIAs were accounted for before taking any action. The Senate POW Committee is going to be releasing its report sometime in the next week. That should be fairly favorable regarding Vietnam's cooperation on this issue. I think, as I said, Clinton's in a difficult position, because American businesses are going to be looking to him to give them some support. And it's going to be hard to argue that in an age when Americans are shut out of a number of markets overseas through the actions of foreign governments, that we're going to be continued to shut out of a foreign market because of the actions of our own government.
You brought up the Senate Select Committee on POW MIA Affairs. Let me pose this question to Douglas Pike. Do you have any insights into what that report is likely to say about whether or not POWs were left behind in Vietnam?
No, I don't. I think it'll conclude that there are no live Americans. There may have been some. That there were some people knew, particularly in Laos, did not get out. But I think that's an issue that's going away. We're always going to have it with us to the end of time. It's like the John F. Kennedy conspiracy thesis. But as a significant political factor, I think it's... Well, let me return to this Bill Clinton business, because that really is the operative issue. And I think both your questions and Michael's, some of Michael's remarks indicate exactly what is the problem. It is a dynamic in which Bill Clinton would prefer that not to think about Vietnam for about a year, to let the dust settle and let the sting of this anti-war demonstrator and you know, the vilification that went on, just let it settle. And I've gotten this from people, journalists and others who cover the campaign. The question is whether he's going to be able to get away with this, and I don't think he can. There is, as Michael said, a renewed campaign by American business to put heat on the White House. There's a recently formed Vietnam U.S. Chamber of Commerce, similar to these overseas chambers of commerce. There's a lobby in Washington run by a woman named Virginia Foote, who has a major lobbying campaign with a lot of money behind it. So there will be this enormous pressure on Clinton on the one hand, and there will be his druthers, if you will, just to let the thing go for about a year. But my guess is he's not going to be able to get away with this. I think the pressure is going to begin fairly soon, and he is going to cede to it or succumb, whatever you want to say.
Well, what about pressure by POW MIA groups, which have consistently said they don't want to see the embargo lifted unless they have a satisfactory answer to what happened to prisoners of war and soldiers missing in action? Which group do you think will outweigh the other? There are obviously two major groups in this equation: business groups, which will pressure for a lifting of the embargo, and POW MIA groups, which say no.
Right. That's exactly precisely the problem Clinton has in weighing these. It's not which I think is most important, it's which Bill Clinton thinks are the most significant. I tended to underestimate this Rambo crowd influence as being a kind of fringe element that didn't have real central major political clout. But in the last month or so, the veterans in a broader sense have gotten into this. The American Legion commander, for example, wrote a very stiff letter to Bush about this, and it surprised me, because I thought they hadn't been heard from that much in the past, and now they seem to be weighing in on the side of what I'd call the extremists on this. I still don't think these are major political actors. I mean, they in the terms of who has clout in Washington, we're not talking about veterans in toto. The veterans, you understand, are widely split on this. In fact, I think most veterans, if you took a poll, would favor diplomatic recognition, as this very vocal and rather vociferous and sometimes very sick minds, in my opinion, who are attracting the attention. So I assume Clinton and his people are smart enough to sort out the genuine pressure from the kind of lunatic fringe pressure.
Michael Scown, are you concerned at all by pressure from POW MIA groups?
Yes, because I think the especially the families obviously have a legitimate concern that they want their questions answered, and they're afraid of losing whatever leverage the United States has. I think businesses are concerned obviously about this as well, because there's been a lot of reluctance within the American business community to speak out publicly on normalization of relations with Vietnam for precisely this issue. And people had a hard decision to make as to whether they thought that an early lifting of the embargo would retard the process or speed it up. And there was also a question of whether normalization should be linked to the MIA issue at all.
Could I say one thing more about this linkage? If you really want to, this is in diplomatic terms, it's called resolution of casualties issue. And if you really want to solve this, the way to do it is to get an American ambassador and an embassy into Hanoi and begin the process of tracing this as exactly as you trace any kind of lost persons. Now, there's thousands, tens of thousands of Vietnamese who served in the South who know about crash sites, who know about capturing prisoners, who may have their dog tags and other war souvenirs that they brought home. They're scattered now. Most of them are retired in the villages of across Vietnam. Now, the Vietnamese government may be a totalitarian, but it cannot order these people to do things like turn in this information. The way you do it is you get American presence in there, and you start looking, running down these people. You try, start being nice to them and do some favors for them, and they start telling you things that you want to know. That's the way you do it. You don't do it by putting pressure at the top. The Vietnamese government has done everything, I think, that's within reason to resolve this issue, and they've reached the point where they cannot go any further. It's only if you win the goodwill of the individuals involved in Vietnam that you're going to move the thing forward significantly.
And you think that can be achieved by actually reestablishing diplomatic ties so that we can have officials directly in the country?
It's like any place you try to find out information from a lot of people. You have to go and talk to them. You have to be nice to them. You have to make it in their interest to talk. It's a standard research project, and you cannot do it through this imperious denunciations and ultimatum and so on.
I was hoping to have Chen Vu, who is a Vietnamese immigrant, on the program to give the perspective from the Vietnamese community. He's not here yet. We hope he's on his way. But Michael Scown, let me try to bring forth his side of the argument. Some Vietnamese immigrants argue that the embargo should not be lifted, that the communist government should continue to be strangled economically until it falls to its knees and dissolves. Have these groups been putting pressure on your business group at all to stop asking the Bush administration to ask to lift the embargo?
No, if anything, it's been the reverse. I've had more inquiries from Vietnamese who are interested in going back to Vietnam and doing business rather than any attempts to get us to stop what we're doing. I think the idea that the U.S. can unilaterally topple the Vietnamese government through an economic embargo is naive. In the first place, the impact of the embargo is really not on the government per se, but on the people in the street, and it's unlikely that they're going to rise up and do anything. Another aspect of all of this is that the embargo has really unraveled in that the U.S.'s allies, a number of whom fought in Vietnam, the Australians, the South Koreans, the French, are all actively doing business in Vietnam. And some of our allies who sort of tacitly went along with the embargo up to a point, such as Japan and Singapore, are now getting ready to heavily invest in Vietnam. Japan is ready to come forth with foreign aid. And at that point, the embargo really loses whatever coercive effect it had. So I think the idea that we can change internal political affairs through economic means is not really workable in the real world.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu. We are talking about relations between the U.S. and Vietnam. My guests are Michael Scown and Douglas Pike. If you'd like to be a part of this conversation, the number to call is 863-2476. 863-2476 is the number once again. You mentioned Japan and Singapore and other foreign countries, Michael Scown, who are investing in Vietnam already. What does the U.S. have to gain economically in terms of dollars from doing business in Vietnam? And if you can tie that at all to the Bay Area specifically, that would be even better.
Well, I think Vietnam is obviously a very underdeveloped country. In my mind, it's going to be a long-term play as opposed to someplace where people are going to get rich quickly. But Vietnam has all the factors that have made a number of other developing markets in East Asia very successful. If you look at what's happened in Thailand, South Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, and Indonesia over the last 15 to 20 years, you don't have to have a PhD in economics to see that Vietnam has some real potential. We've got a large labor force, high degree of education, high literacy rate. People are very hard workers. There's a very good potential for a number of industries there. In addition to that, Vietnam is strategically located in a very fast-growing region of the world's economy, has a lot of physical resources that would be very useful to a number of businesses. And there's obviously just a need for a lot of items that are either manufactured or services that are capable of being produced or provided from the United States. Now, for Bay Area companies, obviously California has strong ties in the Pacific Rim. You know, there are a number of companies in the Bay Area that are interested in petroleum or major financial center banks or providing infrastructure. There are also a number of people involved in import-export or textile manufacturing, natural resources extraction, tourism. You know, Vietnam is a natural additional market within Asia for these people. And I think for that reason, Vietnam is important to both California and the United States economy.
Douglas Pike, is the business environment in Vietnam really as good as Michael Scown is painting it?
Well, Michael and I have discussed this at length over a long period of time. I'm a little bit more bearish on this. I'm not sure we really disagree on it. It's just that I tend to look at the systemic impediments toward true economic development in Vietnam, and there are a number of these that I have to overcome. They need a much better leadership, and particularly a better economic leadership. The infrastructure, extremely weak, especially the educational sector. There is a genuine lack of social consensus, north and south, which is really necessary in any society to make progress. You need capital, investment capital, massive, huge amounts of it. And finally, you need reasonably good, amicable foreign relations. Now, in each of these sectors, there are definite problems. They're not insurmountable, but as I say, I don't think Michael and I disagree, and I think we both agree that some American businessmen who have the notion that we can all get rich in Vietnam if we just get in ahead of the Japanese simply is naive. It's not going to be that easy, and it's going to be a tough, competitive world. Sino-Vietnamese from Taiwan and so on, and that whole South China coast are going to be very formidable competition. But I think American business can do very well there if they go in with a realistic view and a more of a longer range view, not just a commodity bartering and some quick financial deal.
Okay, let's take our first call of the day. Richard in San Francisco, you are on Forum with Michael Scown and Douglas Pike.
Okay, good. What I want to say is that the North Vietnamese, are still holding the remains and maybe even live prisoners of war. And the question always comes up, why would the North Vietnamese do such a thing? And the reason that they're still stonewalling is to preserve their victory. They think that they beat us, the greatest country in the world. And that's what they've been bragging about. And they've got the dead tanks and the dead airplanes, and they've got a United States senator's helmet on display in a museum. And they're saying that that they've beaten us, and they've beaten us bad. And the truth is, they've murdered some of our former prisoners of war. We know they've murdered them. People whose pictures appeared on the front page of the Hanoi newspaper never appeared alive again. And they're protecting these murderers because they don't want to turn them over to the World Tribunal as war criminals. They don't want to be branded as war criminals. And it's not just this one incident of the man on the front page of the Hanoi newspaper. There were people who were taken out of their cells and beaten and taken out again and never returned, never seen alive again. And we know who these people, we know who the American people were, and we want to know who killed them. And they're not going to tell us. They're still stonewalling.
Okay, you've made your point. Do you have a question for either of our guests, is that your comment?
Why should we do business with known professional murderers?
Douglas Pike, Michael Scown.
This the test of what we should do with respect to Vietnam turns on American national interest. And that's the only legitimate test. Is it in our national interest to have diplomatic recognition? Now, you can build a case against it, and I think you can build a stronger case for it. Some of what this caller has said would be, I would argue, within the realm of the national interest. That is, we are a moral society, and we should not deal with murderers and thugs and so on. The problem is that most of the countries, of the 140 of them, I'd say about 110, come under this same general caveat. So it is not in our national interest just to deal with people who behave themselves properly and are Democrats and humanitarians and so on. I wish it were that way, but it isn't. We're obliged to deal with some very ugly people. And in doing so, the only test I can think of as a political scientist is is it in our national interest? American people believe that we are so moral and so just and so righteous and so clean-handed that we cannot deal with people who are not this way, then that's a legitimate point. I just think we hurt ourselves seriously in doing so. It's not that kind of a world out there.
All right. Thank you, Richard, for the call. Let's move on to T in Milpitas. You're on forum. T in Milpitas, are you still there?
Participant from the Vietnamese community here. I listen to your program, and I want to express my opinion as an immigrant.
All right.
You know, I understand why the American corporation want to do business in Vietnam, but because they don't want to be left behind. But I think one of the conditions for the establishment of diplomatic relations with Vietnam should be the respect of human rights and democracy. You know, if China experience is of an indication, you know, when you lift embargo, you know, the Chinese regime still oppress people, and they don't hesitate to massacre the students in Tiananmen Square. So if you lift the trade embargo for Hanoi, you know, you still have an autocratic regime which doesn't hesitate to oppress and massacre its people. So I think the respect of human rights and democracy should be two of the conditions for an establishment of diplomatic relations with Hanoi. And I think this is the opinion of the majority of the Vietnamese immigrants overseas.
Let's give Michael Scown a chance to respond. Does your group have a response to that?
Well, I guess on this issue, I'd rather speak on my own behalf. I'm not sure I can speak for the group as we represent a number of businesses. I think you've got a valid point, but there are a number of countries that we have tried to isolate either diplomatically or economically in hopes of changing their internal political systems, and I can't really think of an instance in which we've succeeded. There are also a number of countries with whom we trade or do business or recognize diplomatically where the presence of foreigners either teaching, living, investing, or just traveling as tourists has actually had some sort of ameliorative effect on internal politics. And I think at this point in Vietnam's development, they're going to get access to capital, services, technology from other countries if the U.S. doesn't go in. So we're not going to be able to stop that from happening. If they do change their internal policies, it's going to be something that they decide. We're not going to be able to coerce them into doing it. We may, however, by dealing with them and by being present there, play a bigger role in that than we would if we weren't there. And at the same time, as Doug said, it's also in our national interest to maintain a channel of communications and to position ourselves so that we aren't totally eclipsed by the rest of the world that's investing there.
But may I speak? May I have a...
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, it's maybe right. You know, if we invest in Vietnam, you know, we can open the door for to import the concept of democracy and freedom. But, you know, maybe it takes time. But from the investment point of view, I think it's better for you to invest in a non-communist regime which has all investment law, which has bankruptcy law, corporation, accounting procedure, and all kind of contract law. But under the communist regime, they don't have these laws, and they might violate the contract laws any time. So I think it's the best interest of the American corporation to invest in a non-communist regime.
Mr. Scone?
Well, I think all things being equal, as a lawyer, I'd agree with you. I'd rather invest in a non-communist regime that has a much more developed legal system. Unfortunately, opportunities are usually accompanied by risks. And Doug mentioned the fact that Vietnam has underdeveloped infrastructure in a lot of areas, and that's true of their legal system as well as their transport and banking systems. The opportunity there, though, is that if you have American companies or American lawyers present, we're going to play a role in how that system develops. Vietnam has made a fairly ambitious start at enacting a foreign investment regime. And they have taken a look at a number of countries in the region and a number of countries in the world to find examples of how they should be doing these things. And they've still got a long way to go. And if I were advising you as an attorney, advising somebody who's going to invest there, I'd say you have to really understand that you're not going to have much legal recourse if your investment goes sour. All that being said, it's still an interesting market, and I think American businesses ought to have the opportunity to take the chance.
I'd say a word about this great debate on how to move Vietnam toward a more open society. It's been a running debate since the end of the war. And there are, again, two legitimate positions. One, you force political change through stonewalling. The second, you cause it through inducement, and carrot and stick approach. The history of this is that neither of these works very well. But I would say that the way to change Vietnam and what you really want to happen there is to move from a hard authoritarian society to a soft authoritarian society, exactly like South Korea did, and Taiwan, and Singapore, Indonesia, and so on. And to do that, I think the best way is to get into the country in non-subversive ways and put a lot of emphasis, I would say, in terms of Americans, on education. There's a woeful lack of adequate education in Vietnam today. As they tell you at Hanoi University, we're still turning out students for the bicycle age. We should be turning them out for the computer age. And an emigre Vietnamese who really wants to change Vietnam, I would advise, and if he's got the money to do it, go to Vietnam, start a technical high school, and start teaching kids science and math and computer engineering and so on. That will be more... of effective change. That's why East Europe changed. That's why the Soviet Union changed. That's why China changed very rapidly up to the point of Tiananmen Square.
At this point, let me say that we did extend an invitation to a Vietnamese emigre by the name of Chen Vu. He apparently is unable to make it after all. Let's move on to the next caller, Rivka in Berkeley. You're on forum.
Yes, now you're going to hear the other side of the coin. First of all, Maya, you are the best host that's ever been on this program, and I hope you stay for the long term. And I want to know where this Richard and these other people are coming off. The United States blatantly invaded Vietnam for no reason than creating another market for international corporations to have more cheap slave labor and resources that they can plunder from another small country. And the fact that the Vietnamese fought so effectively proves that the government that they have is the right government for them and the one that they want. And anybody who is a prisoner of war is a war criminal. And therefore, I don't think these senatorial committees and whoever they are have any right whatsoever to go there and pester these people who are so really super decent that they're even dealing with those senators.
Okay, Rivka, so what's your question? Do you have a question?
Well, yeah, my question is, where do they come off talking like that? They have no right whatsoever to do that. It's the Americans who made this war on Vietnam who are the war criminals and should be in an international war crimes tribunal. It is not the Vietnamese. And the fact that the Vietnamese, in spite of all the embargo, have such a much better quality of life than the people of Thailand speaks for itself.
Okay, let's give our guests a chance to respond. Douglas Pike, you sound like you've been dying to respond.
Right. It's good to see that Marxism is alive somewhere in the world. It certainly isn't alive in the former Marxist-Leninist societies. I really don't know where to begin. As to American war guilt, I reject this notion entirely. We went to Vietnam to try to put things right. Exactly what put things right meant different things to different people, but we did it for the best of motives. We did not succeed in this, but that does not impugn our motives. We are now facing exactly the same problem in Bosnia, or in Yugoslavia, in Cambodia, in a sense, in Somalia, and so on. And